The following program is an abridged audio version of the streaming video talk show, A Wonderful Chaos. The hosts are Andy Chaliff and Bambos Dimitriou. The format is entirely casual, unscripted conversation. If you'd like to watch a live taping or participate with your comments in real time, subscribe to A Wonderful Chaos on YouTube, Facebook, Periscope, or Twitch.
Our goal is always to help the communities that we are immersing ourselves in on a small scale. But the bigger hope is that the journey our students go through unlocks something in them that maybe this product or service doesn't change the world, but we have changed them and turned them into someone who will change the world in the future or change their goals in life about making an impact on the world in a positive way versus I'm going to be the richest person I can be.
It's a wonderful chaos. Beautifully random, messy and glorious.
Solo or tandem?
We work to find rest and fight to find peace. Both head and the heart,
like I left you and me.
What are we doing here?
You mean listening to this show?
Where the more that you learn is the less that you know. Where the wounded are healers
and the atheists pray.
It's a wonderful chaos, and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos, and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos, and we like it that
way. To my left, Ronnie from Italy, my wife.
Hi, everyone.
Bambos has a young woman in his life at the moment, and they're gone on a vacation.
So here I am, the female Bambos for today.
Today we have a very interesting show for many reasons. Brad Cracchiola is someone who I went to high school with. I haven't spoken to Brad in over 30 years because we weren't in the same circles. So now there's no reason probably in the past for us to connect. Yeah. So now we found a reason to connect, which is great because he was part of a film that was made recently. And that film is called Lives, Not Grades. And it's a subject dear to my heart, because I'm spending a lot of time working with education and what's gone on and how we've evolved from the Industrial Revolution to a system where it's not quite addressing the issues that we have today. So when I saw on kind of on the Facebook world that Brad had done or was part of this movie, I didn't see the movie, but I was really interested because, as you know, I'm working a lot with education, especially in like Cleveland area. Education called SOL, Self-Organized Learning Environments, Sugata Mitra, who I've also had some contact with, where it's more of a interest-driven learning. So more of students deciding what curiosities they have and how that curiosity defines their learning trajectory.
So it's more organic. It's driven by your own interest, not because someone said you have to memorize those math equations.
Yeah. So it's not reading, writing, arithmetic. It's, hey, there's a drum on the counter. What is the drum made out of? And then they start to discuss the materials of the drum. And then that leads to questions like, how do we manufacture drums? And then that becomes a research question. And then how do waves work? So how does sound then move through the air? How do we hear things? So it's the curiosity that drives the learning and not, hey, by the third quarter of your fourth year, you need to understand this thing. Yeah. And that's something that I've spent, as you know, a lot of time with working on, especially in the Cleveland area. And so I'm always fascinated because I see that in this documentary, Lives Not Grades, it was a touch of a word used for it's often project-based learning. So where do we create a project? And in that project, students or learners will have the opportunity to grow, not because it's programmatically set they need to learn something in a certain order, but because life throws problems at you. Mm. And learning how to solve the problems, you actually just become better at life.
Yeah, and actually you become actually more useful.
Yeah.
Useful in real life. So you directly delivers value to people around you, to the society.
And you're more valuable when you graduate because you have practice already. You haven't lived in just theoretical constructs. it reminds me of when I went to my Swiss girlfriend. I don't know if I told you, but I went to her mom's house once, and they lived in the village. And I sat at the table, and it was a little, it was really out in the mountainside. And she said to me, "What did you learn in school?" And I said, "I learned how to think." Mm. And she said, "Okay, that's great, but what did you learn?" And I said, "I learned how to think." And she really had, she wanted me as far away from her daughter as possible, because that learning how to think wasn't enough.
Mm.
So,
and somehow that reminds me of the fact that the one thing that got my father actually really impressed by with you is your ability to actually create things. And there is a papier mâché.
So of all the things I've done, he likes that I can do paper mâché. Yeah, I love that.
My dad doesn't really care that you're coaching all this high-flying bigwig in the whole world, but the fact that you can actually create something.
Because I can create paper mâché.
Wow.
I say we bring Brad on now. I'm sure that, hello, nice to see you. Hi.
Yes, before I embarrass you.
No.
Hi,
Brad.
Now
make
I
want to
see
mâché.
The paper mâché. I want to see them.
It was actually an engineering problem. We have a door on the top floor of our house, which is a hidden cupboard. It's a shelf, which is built so you don't even know that it's a door. And I have Delft, which is this very heavy Dutch pottery. So I have hundreds of pieces on a shelf. And the Delft on that door was so heavy that you couldn't close the door, because when you shut the door, actually it would fling itself back open and all the Delft would shoot off.
Oh.
So to keep the illusion alive, I had to figure out how to make Delft in paper mâché, so that you now look at it, you look at the shelf and you can't tell it's actually not Delft. So.
This is like
going to the Louvre to see the Mona Lisa, but it's actually a forgery of the Mona Lisa.
Exactly. And
the
funny
whole world
thing,
comes to take pictures of the Mona Lisa that's not the real one.
Yes. And the beauty is that I've noticed that in life, if the brain has an expectation, even if the thing looks horrible, they still will think it's paper, that it's not paper mâché.
Yes. So it never fails. Everybody thinks for the first time when they see it, they thought it was from ceramic.
It's a ceramic piece, although it's not. Yes. So first, let's acknowledge, I knew that the first person we'd get a comment from is your high school coach, J.C. Barnett, who says he's listening attentively. He also wanted to remind me to remind you that you were the captain of the water polo team when you were at the school.
Yes. Yeah,
how does it feel?
And he's still my coach. I still call him my coach.
That's beautiful. This movie you're in, right? Would we call it a movie? Would we call it a documentary? How would you phrase it?
It's a documentary.
You hadn't been on a movie, as far as I know, before, or any kind of cinematic. Or was this your first time?
I mean, I think I've done an interview on TV before, but not like a film crew, like filming me in real life and then pulling me out for interviews, that kind of thing. No.
And how did it feel to see yourself in that light?
It's weird. Yeah. That ego in all of us, like you're worried about how you're going to be portrayed and, oh, I could have said something different. And I wish I had thought of something more clever or something, but it's authentic, right? I mean, and ultimately I think the reality of it is what makes it compelling.
Do you feel that you were portrayed as you really feel yourself to be when you look at it, or you feel like that's not really you?
Well, I feel like it was good. Yeah. I feel like it was pretty fair. There's, so little, like we talked about before, it's such a short edit of a year and actually in the original cut, there was more sort of back and forth with, between instructors and students that had to get edited out because the feedback we got was nobody cares about the instructors, which is probably fair. Like you're telling a story about the student's journey. So there was less of us. So then you only get a one piece of a personality,
Yeah.
So it took a whole year to for that whole process, and it ends up into a 1 hour or maybe 1.5 hours.
53 minutes, I believe, in the end.
Yeah, I think it was 56 minutes or something. But
for those who don't know, it might be good for you to share what the setup was, just so those who come to the show who aren't aware of it, they know what the whole idea behind it was.
Okay, so it didn't start with a documentary. It started with an idea that there are serious global problems in the world that simply don't get the attention they need. Not because there aren't tons of people who are smart and interested, often because there's no economic incentive for companies to put their resources behind it, right? If Apple could make money solving the refugee crisis, then that's what they'd be doing instead of selling iPhones, right?
Yeah.
At the same time, we realize that not just at USC, but at all universities and even high schools around the world, there are brilliant students who have, unlike our growing up years, have sort of a newfound understanding that they can go do things without permission and are desperate for real world experience. And our idea was, what if we captured the best students we could find, brought them into more of like an incubator, almost like a startup incubator, taught them the fundamental thinking techniques about problem solving. So design thinking, systems thinking, lean startup methodology, all of the techniques that are used in the for-profit startup world, and then turn them loose on a problem, on a global problem that does not get the attention of corporations. And then, can we scale that by telling the story? Can we scale that and let that idea spark across more universities? So suddenly we leverage this massive amount of talent, of brilliant people, to change the world.
Yeah, because a lot of times people can graduate from a university and not have any practical skill or application of anything.
Yeah.
Which always blows my mind that at the end you start from, you know, the bottom of the rung, although you've got all of this education behind you.
Yeah. And often, I mean, I find that even you get the degree and the degree teaches you some fundamentals of maybe what your career may be, but it doesn't teach you how to do your job. You learn that on the job, right? You learn the realities. You know, for me, my background was engineering. I learned math. I learned laws of physics. I learned how to apply it. But then when you get into the real job, it's like, okay, all that's great, but this is what we do, and you need to learn how to do what we do. And you're starting all over again, right? It's the practical experience that academia can only take you so far.
Yeah.
But you don't learn how to swim by reading a book. You learn how to swim by getting in the pool and struggling through it.
Yeah. Some of the core messages that I really liked was that, you know, I think one of your quotes was, you're going to fall down 9 times and you got to get up 10. And and I think that the more, and it's not part of the education, because I mentioned before we came on, one of the times I laughed in the documentary and I had a cringe in my stomach was when you made that statement, is that, you know, you got to fall and get up and you got to fall and get up. And then right after, the other person who was at the university said, I don't like Brad's thinking here. I think it's not good to fail. And I thought, oh no, that's exactly for me the problem as we have it today, is that people get so perfectionist that they actually don't even act and learn quickly from the mistakes that they make, because there's always going to be assumptions.
Yeah. And you know, academia, all of school from elementary school is programming your kids like you need to get good grades, you need to pass your tests, because each grade, your grades set you up for the next grade, right? Elementary sets you up for high school. High school is critical to get into a good university. A good GPA in university sets you up for a career. And it's gotten to the part where, and I don't think this is by design, but it's just evolved to the point where there is not much room for failure. But in my experience, failure is not the opposite of success. It's how we learn. It's the path to success. And, you know, if you're scared to try, if you're scared to fail, you're never going to create something new.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what entrepreneurship and invention is all about. Right. You don't make a light bulb the first time.
No.
Right. You don't invent anything right the first time.
Yeah.
You fail many, many times and figure out the way.
Yeah, as we're talking about the difference between an academic world, academia, and people who are actually practitioners in, mm-hmm. in real world solving problems, that reminds me of the school system here in the Netherlands that for higher education, they have what they call universities, and you have Hogeschool, which the literal translation is high school, but it's not high school. It's the same level as universities. But my understanding is, you know, I didn't grow up here, so I jumped into the university here right away. But I think the idea was that universities are for people to learn how to think, just to think abstractly. So they are not expected to actually be useful in the society necessarily, but they can think about abstract problems. They can philosophize about things and write books, create thinkings. And then this more practice oriented.
I think we call that trade schools in the US, or I don't even know if we have them, but that was a term I think they used, trade schools.
Yeah. So what do you think about that kind of structure where people actually from the early stage of their lives, they're already being separated? You are going to be practitioners.
Yeah, because in the U.S., like in the U.S., we don't really, in fact, it's almost like if you went into a trade school, it's almost like you weren't smart and that's not a great life. Where in Europe, if you become an electrician, you're making a lot more money than someone that goes to university most of the time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even in the States, I think you can be a plumber and make $200,000 a year, you can be a PhD and make $75,000 a year after, not to mention all the academic debt you've acquired.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, you know, I think you're right. I think there's a need for both. There's a need for people to sort of think and to sort of focus, you know, their mental, you know, I mean, everybody has different skills, right? But for me, it's not even necessarily just about a trade school, but I think entrepreneurship in general is about a capacity for risk taking.
Yeah.
And, you know, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Michael Dell, Elon, I don't know about Elon Musk, but all these guys dropped out of college, right? Zuckerberg, right? All of these famous entrepreneurs, they don't have their college degree. Google hires people without degrees. Most of the engineers that landed a man on the moon did not have a degree in the 60s. Mm. And then the world shifted to this prioritization of, well, you got to have a bachelor's and an MBA is even more important. And that just sort of tipped the scales towards this mad rush to this like sort of false necessity. But it's not the same as your ability to create and to think and to solve problems and be a valuable contributor, right?
Yeah. Yeah. When I talked about this project-based learning when we began, I was wondering if in a way, I mean, that whole year-long project the project for those who are watching is basically interdisciplinary teachers, I would call you were adjunct professors, or I don't know what the title would have been, but were brought in to mentor these that were then the city or this village that was being taken care of is called Moria. Is that the?
So Moria is a refugee camp on the island of Lesbos in Greece. And it happens to be one of the, when you think about refugees trying to get to Europe, I think Turkey to Greece is 6 miles maybe at the closest point, right? So refugees are coming from Afghanistan, from all over the world, right? Where for various reasons, they have to leave their homes and they're looking for a place. And usually the first place they're trying to get to is Europe. Yeah. And the Greek island of Lesbos happens to be like the closest, like literal piece of Europe that you can get to. And so boats upon boats upon boats of refugees, you know, show up in the middle of the night just to get to European land and claim amnesty.
When you were there, did you get to see any of this while you were there?
Yeah. I've been several times, and we actually went into the camps. We worked with refugees. There's two camps on that island. You know, there are many refugee camps all over the world, and they're all struggling. They're all overwhelmed. They're all underfunded. We chose that one because it was, you had to pick one, right? So it's sort of the think global, act local kind of thing. Like, we had to pick one. It's important. We felt it was important for our students. Okay. So fundamentally, the goal of this 1 year program is not to, teach students project-based learning, although that is what we do. The goal is to help refugees in this case. And we're not doing the refugee crisis this year or last year, but for the first 2 years we did. But the goal was to make an impact in the world, for students to make a meaningful impact, for them to create a product, service, or nonprofit that could help people make a real change. In order to do that, you have to understand the problem. You have to immerse yourself intimately. You have to know it. Google articles is not a way to understand the problem. You have to go meet people. You have to see it firsthand. You have to smell it. You have to live it. You have to have a personal experience to understand what doesn't make it into an article. Just like the documentary had to get cut down, every single article you read has to be distilled down, and much of the context is missing.
And I'm curious, because when I saw, because in the documentary, you came to like five products, basically, that you then go through how they were successfully or less successfully implemented. But how many did we not see, or really just ideas where you could see the unrefined thinking, like really big assumptions being made, where you said, wow, guys, you're so far off of what they're really needing, but you're making assumptions about that. Did you see that happen? Because I couldn't imagine that it wasn't happening and you didn't see it on the documentary.
Yeah. No, again, right. It had to be edited down. So we started with five teams. We had five teams the whole time. One of the fundamental things we believed was, we will not tell them what they can or cannot build, because that insight and freedom to make that choice, freedom to fail, is an important part of it. And what if they're right and I'm wrong, right? Yeah. Who am I to know better, right? So what we did was we had more of a mentorship kind of relationship. So you know, I've lived my life in the product development world. I understand how to sort of understand problems, how to test hypotheses. So what we did was, they generated lots of problems or opportunities that they could address. And then they started working through, based on their team skill sets and based on, you know, what they were interested in, which is a big, like, you have to be passionate about what you're building, or you won't have the drive to stick through it. It will fail if you're not committed, right? So that passion is so important. Yeah, go ahead.
I wanted to touch on that just quickly before you go on, because one of the most powerful interviews I ever saw was when Gates and Jobs were on the stage, and then they asked what made that those two were successful. I don't know what the actual question was, but what made that you were able to succeed? And the humor of it was, they said there were so many times that it was so easy to leave because the problems were so big. So the only thing that made that we got this far was that our passion to keep going. So it was never about the success. It was the passion of the journey. So I can completely identify with it, and I understand how hard it is to transmit it to a younger mind who might think, "Oh, this is just a good idea," but not lacking all the passion to make it actually work. Yeah,
yeah, and so we're in our fourth year, and we've spent a lot of time thinking about, how do you build teams that have all the skills? How do you set them up for success? But what I have, you know, come to realize is that, one, getting the students inspired So giving them a personal connection to the problem, again, part of the reason you must go there, you must be there firsthand to have a personal connection. And two, them being personally excited about what they are building are some of the largest drivers to whether our teams over these last years succeed or fail. And really, it's exactly that, because it will get tough for every single team. You will stall, you will struggle, you will not know where to turn or how to solve what you're doing. If you're not in love with what you're doing, you're gonna give up. You're gonna break down. And so you have to be borderline obsessed about it.
Yeah.
So we don't tell them, we don't force anything on them. We let them find that obsession and then we let them run.
It's funny, because on the show, the most obsessive that I would have seen from the show would have been the person that made the jacket, and the least obsessive from the perspective of just my viewing would have been the shower. So it's funny, because not that either one, neither tended to be successful from the outcome it looked like, but it just seemed like the vision and purpose and drive of the you couldn't have people that looked further apart than those two groups. Would that have also been true? Or is that just my perception?
So I think that, I don't know. I think the teams were all fairly, yes, certainly some teams were more obsessed with what they were building than others. And that does affect their ability or the impact their success potential. I think that was our first year. And one of the other things that's really important and one of the things that we teach is that, ideas are easy, execution is hard. And to be honest, 1 year is not a lot of time for any business to start and to gain traction. And we do a lot of prototyping, but sometimes you need more. And I think all five of the ideas had those teams chosen to continue beyond the course would have iterated the problem, iterated the solution, and found one that actually, and like with the case of the shower, actually there was a little bit of context missing in the movie about why these showers. And it's actually not about, I mean, part of it is about the hygiene of the showers that were available, but mostly it's about sexual assault in those showers, and about when you decentralize the showers so that you're closer to your protective group, you are safer, right? And so there was a different kind of, but it takes time to get to work through the problems. And like one of the teams, Duet, that the micro philanthropy, they're still going. But they're still working. It's not like they're on cruise control now. You know, any new business, it's a grind for years and years, and you have to be committed.
Yeah.
So I think any of those teams could have found some level of success had they been able to keep going. But also, these are students who have life plans from before they join this course, and we don't expect everybody to throw away their dreams for this one. Some people have said, okay, this is my new passion, I'm doing this. Mm-hmm. Others say, okay, I invested, I spent some time, now I want to go to med school or whatever. And that's perfectly, we support that as well.
Yeah.
So this is a program that has run for multiple years. I think you said that it's the fourth year now.
This is our fourth year now. Yeah.
Yeah. And all four times it's all about the refugee crisis, refugee problems,
The first 2 years were the refugee crisis. So we invested for 2 years there. Last year, because of COVID, we were not able to travel. So we decided, why don't we address this crisis and focus on people here at home in LA? So the whole course was virtual last year. And we, our teams built products and services to address the homelessness crisis in LA, small businesses, food waste. And so that's where they pivoted. And then this year we are looking at, we're taking a little bit more of an environmental, and sort of native culture. We're going to Alaska. And so we're looking at sort of economy and preservation of native cultures and preservation of the environment. And it's just a rich, it's a rich opportunity out there as well.
And so you have been involved in this program from the very first years, right? So you've been doing this also for the fifth year.
I basically created it with my three colleagues,
So
I'm a maker and an engineer. I understand. I've written software. I've done hardware products. We have another instructor who's an architect and a designer. And then Birchin, who you mentioned, she is no longer teaching it, but she is a researcher. So she understands user research, which is a fundamental part of understanding as well, and still participates and helps us. And then Dan, the director, is actually our storyteller. And so he helps teams because we strongly believe that being able to tell your story in a compelling way is important because you have to fundraise, you have to motivate people to help, right? These things don't happen on their own, right? Again, these aren't high profit opportunities. So it's about connecting with people. It's about making the data meaningful, personal, memorable.
So how is it for you to work with students? Because I think, you know, you also have a professional career where you deal with grown-ups, with professionals, and now you're mentoring these young people. How was it for you?
Oh, it's great. I mean, I do love, I love it. They're so talented. They're so smart. I laugh at like myself at that age compared to the high achievers that these kids are. I'm just like, oh my God, what a waste I was. Like I did nothing of value, you know, but it's a beautiful thing to like, basically like give them permission to just go out in the world and, you know, go crazy and do things that they think, I'm not the one who can do that. Like, yeah, why not? Mm. You are if you believe you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that building the confidence at a young age is something that immediately pays back dividends because it's that confidence, which, as you say, gives you the ability to go and say, I can do something because I knew I didn't think I could do it before and I did it. So why can't I now do it again? Right.
Yeah. And, you know, we also take away that stigma of failure. So what we tell students is like, yeah, let's try and do something meaningful. And if it doesn't work out, it's not going to hurt your grade. We don't grade on that. We don't grade on, you know, because entrepreneurship and innovation is risk. And you can't take that out. If you're doing that, you're just not trying. You're not doing something meaningful if you can guarantee success.
Yeah. Is that, I think this is really great actually to destigmatize failure. Cause like you said, that's actually the best opportunity for people to learn. If we ignite that at this age, isn't that a bit too late? Because they're probably already grown up, you know, the way, you know, kids grow up from the 3 years old, they already have plans about what university they want to go to. Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
you're right. So interesting thing, Andy, Dan Ryan watched our demo day, which is demo day is when our teams present their products. Basically they're pitching for fundraising and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he watched it and he said, hey, Brad, I think I'm going to go talk to Notre Dame High School and see if they want to build this course at the high school level. And I said, all right, let's do it. So we're actually talking with the principal and one of their teachers is coming out to our class to kind of check it out. And they want to build something obviously scaled down for the high school level. But there's a lot of like reprogramming that has to do with the professors there about,
yeah,
failure and grading and how do you teach this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's where it gets tricky because in a way, if it goes against the norms of what we consider to be education, then, you know, how does the current paradigm deal with the new paradigm or whatever that's going to look like?
Exactly. Exactly.
You, in the show, one of my favorite moments was when the inflatable jacket had different team members, and each team member had to articulate what its purpose and value, and obviously they threw one of the people under the bus. I don't remember what the name of that student was, but he clearly they edited it even to make it worse than it was, I'm sure. But what made me laugh was that he articulated in a way that you would never think it would succeed, and then 1 second later, another person on the same team articulates it in a way you're like, wow, this sounds like a great idea. And it goes back to storytelling. It's how hysterical it is that the idea itself is not as important as the ability to articulate the idea in a way that it captures another person's imagination.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's so true. And that's why we do that. That's why we put them on the spot over and over throughout the year. We make them pitch their business or profit, you know, product, pitch it to us as if we were investors.
Yeah.
And we shred them, to be honest. Like we do not accept a student presentation, right? We expect it to be real world, like you're pitching to a venture capitalist and this better be. And so it's a very steep learning curve and a very rude awakening for these students, but it's also amazing to see how good they get at the end because they've just been through the grinder learning how to tell a compelling story.
But there was a moment that was really quite beautiful when, and the student had a good point. When he set the boundary with you, the three of you were kind of putting him under the spotlight, and he said, "You two, you are not listening to me. And if you communicate this way, we cannot proceed." Like, it was turning the tables because in a way he was saying, if I don't feel heard, then this, and actually I have to say from a standpoint of like the kind of trait that's going to make him successful the rest of his life, that was it. Which is funny because he might not get a good grade in a traditional setting because they'd say, you know what, he's not subservient enough to the educator. Yeah.
Yeah. No, you're totally right. And we encourage students to challenge us. We like nobody calls me professor. They call me Brad. Like I want to be on a level of peers, of colleagues, not a Because otherwise they just ask me, what should I do?
Yeah.
And that misses the whole point. If you have to ask someone else, then you're not going to fix this problem because the problem exists because everybody's thinking about it the same way. You need to think about it in a new way. But we love that. We love to argue with our students. It takes a while. Not all of them will get there to the point where they're willing to push back. But the ones that do, like him, we love them the most.
Yeah. I would say that I spend a lot of time, especially because in like my coaching work, there's a fine line I'm often found between, I'll often use the word agency, is that if anytime an individual projects any authority onto another individual or superiority, even if it's subtle, then all of a sudden they give away their power without even knowing it. And I think our systems and societies and education, especially, they are programmed so that there's in Asia, obviously it's in the DNA. So it's really hard to break the idea that no, we're actually equals, although I will have other experience, but my experience shouldn't trump your ideas.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a hard thing to find.
Yeah, it is. And it's tough because they don't trust us at first, right? Like we tell them, they don't believe us, right? Inside, right? And it takes a long time for them to sort of realize like, oh, I'm not going to like, we will savage you on poor performance, but we will not grade you poorly because of that, because of the failure part. Like we tell them day one, most of you are high achievers and not used to failure. This is going to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because we are not going to sugarcoat this for you. Like you are not going to like what you hear, but it's not going to hurt your GPA where you're worried about getting into med school. As long as you do the work that we ask,
Yeah.
The success and failure or subservience is not part of the grade, right?
Yeah. Is there a qualification for students to enroll to this program? Because I imagine that, you know, they also need to have some basic skills or maybe some qualifications with or interview with regard to their mindset or whether they can even deal
with it. Yeah, because you are putting them in some psychologically difficult situation. If they're not mentally capable of dealing with this, it's not going to be a good ride.
You're right. You're right. And especially with the refugee crisis, there was a lot of very real trauma and tragedy up front. And it affected all of us. Like, none of us were prepared. It was quite quite scary going there. Not scared for myself, but scared for, like, sort of experiencing the tragedy in a way that is not like softened for TV kind of thing, right? A lot of heartbreak. Students do apply. We do look at sort of what skill sets they have. Do they have maker skills? Have they built things in the past? We look for indicators, but we don't judge students based on, we don't exclude a student necessarily, but we do look. It's important for us to build balanced teams. So what we don't have time for is for teams to sort of self-assemble. So we do sort of try to evaluate everybody's skills and pre-sort them into teams.
Yeah.
We allow a little flexibility later in case there is like a personal conflict, but because that'll kill the team too, just like lack of passion.
Yeah.
But fundamentally,
how do you address that? Because that's got to be, if you think about like the skills that are going to allow them to be most successful, it's going to be their ability to get things done and obviously connected to their ability to get along with people, even in uncomfortable situations. Yep. So how do you address issues when two members aren't able to resolve issues between one another?
Yeah. So again, this is not a, you know, a Disneyland ride on rails. We typically do not interfere other than mentorship. So what we will do is we will counsel them both on sort of where we think the issue is. We largely encourage communication, more communication. In the event that a student finally says, can you please transfer me off of this team? Then they have to, we will allow that, but they have to find a team that wants to accept them because we don't want to damage that team's like nice cohesive chemistry, right? If they don't want them, but we've never had a case where nobody wanted them. Right. So, there are some cases where students halfway through the program drop out. There are some students where some of the students just find this is actually not for me. I don't want to be an entrepreneur. This is not, it's extremely demanding of time. It's extremely hard when you're juggling a school load and you have other priorities and stuff. You have to really be kind of obsessed about what we're doing in order for this to work for you. So some students after a semester, they say, okay, I'm out, which is okay too.
Yeah.
Sometimes students leave because of the conflict on their team, and that's unfortunate because we might lose some talented people. But that's just like starting a business too. That's just like the real world, right?
Yeah. But there's no mediation. You won't act as a mediator between them. They either make it work out or they have to move on. There's no, hey, we're going to act as a counselor for the two of you or anything.
No, because I don't believe that you can do that. Like, they have to find it. We'll counsel them.
But not together.
Not together.
That's great. No. I've told Ronnie, because I've gone in, I'm really good at dealing with two people that hate each other, right? Like, that's like my sweet spot. You can hate each other.
Really?
And I'll go in. Oh yeah. It's almost fun for me because I have compassion for each. So I can be in the middle, even as they're yelling with one another, and just say, let me tell you what he's thinking. And then I'll speak for the guy who's not speaking. I'll just, and it's like a playground for me because I don't identify, and I don't, you know, dad yelled at me so much as a kid that I've kind of learned how to create space for the anger. So once you've created spaciousness, you don't get triggered as much. But what I told her was this, is that I see that I'm often prolonging things that would happen quicker if I wasn't there. So I told her one day, I don't know if I'm actually adding any value because of what you just said. It's like, if it's not going to work out, then maybe it was better for it just not to work out.
Yeah.
You know, I can make it, I can prolong it for 2 or 3 years, but usually there's a point where it's just managing something that wasn't really functioning. And so I can prolong it, but does that mean that it's better that way? I remember coming home one day and telling you, I don't even know if what I'm doing is of any value, because just prolonging the inevitable isn't necessarily a great thing. So it speaks to the way you're dealing with it as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, best friends can like love each other, but not want to live together. Right.
Yeah.
Cause they don't get along with each other when it's like that. And similarly in a business, like if you have a different style of work, you just may not ever be on the same page. Right. And we've had students where they just could not see eye to eye. So we moved them to different teams, and then both of them thrived. So there was nobody was wrong. Nobody was the problem.
Yeah.
They just both needed to work with a different culture, right? And work culture is so important for success, right?
Yeah.
And so that culture is an important thing. We also have, you know, we believe, you know, strongly in sort of the culture of, we call it a family. Like, we're collaborative. We're not competitive. We support everybody's wins. We don't pit the teams against each other. We largely pit all of them against us. So they're bonding against, oh my God, can you believe what he said to us? Right? Because we're going to savage them all equally. So they can all be, you know, resentful of us.
Yeah. By the way, we have some comments that came in, so it might be nice to at least share that. So Kate Marley says, hello, old friends. So you've got someone, apparently,
Kate.
Patricia Cracchiola. How do I pronounce your last name?
Cracchiola.
So Patricia is being told that JC is a grandfather as of 3 weeks ago. And he's also asking you, are you getting into the pool? He's interested if you are still representing him in any fashion in the pools of the United States.
Yeah. So I was, pre-COVID, I was swimming a couple times a week. Right now, the only pool I'm getting into is the big blue one that surrounds the world. I surf as much as I can. That's my water time, but,
I
am definitely excited to get back in and be doing laps again, coach. So don't worry. I'll get there.
Bola Long, who comes to us from South Africa, says they call the people technicons, but they are not. Now they're converted into universities, a wrong move. Isn't that funny? It was what we were discussing earlier, is that they follow more of the American system. You know, before there was tradespeople, and we said, oh, we need people that can build stuff, that can do stuff. And now we've relegated that to a lower rung in our mentality in the U.S. at least. And it's really just it's just sad, because it's like it also is weird in a way, because it's there's a degree to which it's a bit condescending, as if one is lesser than another, which drives me crazy in life.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's you know, I think it's tipping back. I do think it's tipping back towards, I think, not so much about the trade school, but just you know, I offered to buy my daughter a book on to learn the ukulele. And she's like, I don't need a book. I've got YouTube. Like, she doesn't need a teacher. She's like, why? Like, I'll go figure it out myself. And that kind of mentality in younger people frees them, I think, in many ways from this, you know, I need to go to college for experts to teach me. And there is definitely a place where you do need university. There is definitely... Yeah. A space that needs that. You do need to learn some things from experts, but there is much experiential that you don't.
Ronnie and I are now learning Spanish with this app Duolingo, and it's scary. It is scary how much an app can manipulate you into learning something, as if it's like frightening. I feel myself getting manipulated, and yet I'm learning, so I'm okay with it.
I love that. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
The link, Bowl Along, and others who want to look, it's actually on our page at A Wonderful Chaos right now. We posted early. It's on PBS. If you just do a search on Google, you'll find it, and it's free of charge. Live's not great. Just do a search on Google, and you'll find it there, and you can download and watch it immediately. Yeah.
Yeah, and thank Paul Nelson for helping us get it to PBS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What were you going to say?
Yeah, no, I was just looking at the comment that just basically said, no, Andy.
I don't know. JC Barnett said, no, Andy. We have no I don't have no idea what that was about, yeah, but yeah. I'm sure I said something that would have offended him. It's very rare that I do. Yeah. Ronnie had a snide remark to me last night, which I said, don't bring it up on the show. But now that bring she's here.
We're unfiltered. Let's do it.
Okay, so Andy only told me that we're going to do this show about refugees. So he was playing the movie, and I was doing the chores in the house. I was just listening to it, so I didn't really watch the full spectrum of the show from the beginning to the end. And my comment back then, not knowing the bigger context that I know now, is, why did you have to go that far away to solve societal problems like the refugees? Yep. I mean, in the United States, you have so much problems, so many problems there already. Why do you have to go so far away? And you go to Greece, to this area where you help the refugees, but is there maybe like a summer vacation attached to it so that it's actually learning, but it's actually holiday? I mean, you know.
You didn't say that to me, but we spent December and January in Los Angeles. We went to the USC campus. I can't tell you how scary it was for the two of us to like drive through some of those streets.
Around campus?
Around campus. Yeah. Around campus. Yeah. So that's why we were thinking, why wouldn't we take care of what's going on right in front of our doorstep and not on the other side of the world?
Sure. Yeah, no, it's absolutely a valid question and criticism. And last year we focused in the United States. So having done both, I do believe that I think taking you out, I'm a big believer in mental models, and especially in the fact that a mental model is not reality. The map is not the territory, right? So you have subconscious assumptions about your world and about how it works, especially where you live, where you're comfort, right? And pulling you out and putting you in a new place, you have no preconceptions. Mm. So I believe it opens you up to seeing opportunities that maybe people there don't see, just like others could come to LA and see things that maybe we don't see. So that's one part I think is really important. The other part is, as I said, what I've found is one of the biggest factors in our team's success is the passion and the persistence. And I do believe the travel part and connecting outside of your circle adds a level of inspiration that is tougher to recreate in your own backyard. But I think your point is still absolutely fair.
Yeah, with hindsight, also, I can imagine that actually taking the students away from where they are now, it also opens up their horizon, you know. So some of the prejudice that I have towards Americans, if I may say so, is that their world is the United States, as if the rest of the world, you know, they always called, you know, U.S. and the rest of the world, which is kind of interesting. So by bringing them to see the other part of the world, also make them realize that they're part of the global citizen. You know, it is there's a bigger.
There's something that he said as well, which goes along the lines of which hit me. I think I intuitively was thinking about it, but you made it very explicit. And I spent a lot of time writing about this. And it is about the preconceived ideas we have. You use the word mental models. And I see that a mental model is so, it's the fish in water. It doesn't realize that the water exists because it is. And what I've seen in my life, and it's actually, I would say the hardest thing an individual has to be confronted with is that whatever they think they know, they have to realize there's also assumptions in the in those knowings. And and without the ability to break the assumptions a few times, you don't realize it because you don't even have an alternative view. So I know, like, when I lived in Japan and in Australia and like those initial places, especially in Japan, because the mental models were so different, like I saw the world in a way that I had never imagined possible because it was so different than what I was accustomed to. And it also meant, like you said, that I saw things that I could do or arrange or do there that that they would have never seen because it wasn't something that they were so used to it as it was, right?
Yep.
The next issue comes design questions. Like, just because I see it doesn't mean that it's something that they would find a value. That's the next issue. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, so when we started building this course, I wrote a manifesto. I wrote a one-page manifesto because I realized that the four of us building the course would need our own roadmap, and we would need something to come back to remind us to, in case we started drifting into traditional academia, to pull us back on the path. But one of the things, and largely it's driven from sort of none of it's totally original other than Lives Not Grades is actually the first tenet of the manifesto, which is where the documentary got its name, to remind us that this isn't about the class, it's about the people we're trying to help. But one of the other tenets of the manifesto was that we need to validate our assumptions all the time. And we do that through testing. You do that through prototyping. You do that through trial and error failure, right? This is where the failure comes back in. But it's exactly that. You have to question every assumption you make, or you will solve a problem that is not actually the problem.
Yeah.
First, you have to solve the right problem before you can solve the problem right. So step one is, are we solving the right problem? And that requires breaking down a lot of assumptions and testing them all to know, are you getting to the right space?
Yeah. Yeah, I did a game. I wanted to create a game that prepared people to die. And so I did the game, I created it, and then I did the quick iteration, right? I did it, and then I had five people in the room, and as we played it, I saw why the game sucked. So I was like now confronted, and I could understand why it sucked only through the playing of the game.
Exactly.
I intermingled really playful questions with really deep, meaningful questions, and it created such a dissonance of like, am I here to laugh or am I here to cry? Like, and then I created the next game, which I'm like, this is even better than the two games but it would have only come out of the experience of having that, that initial test and to see the failure of it, the utter failure.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Any thoughts coming up for you, babe?
Yeah, I was just thinking about the, failing fast and, that I wish that was already invented a long time ago because, in the corporate life that I'm in now, even with, the employees, with young people, a lot of them are so afraid of, making mistakes because, like you said, a lot of young people, they're high achievers. They want to be perfect all the time. But sometimes that's not what matters.
Yeah, and this is exactly why I think failure is more widely accepted in, well, for one, in entrepreneurship, when the stakes are lower, it is easier to fail, especially if it's your own business and you're willing to take the risk. When you're working at a global corporation with shareholders and profit targets and salaries, you obviously, there is less capacity to fail because you will impact a lot of people's lives. It's not sort of taking it with your own, right? So I think as any opportunity grows, the ability to take risks diminishes because of the damage failure can cause, right? Which is exactly why you want to fail. That's why they say fail fast, right?
Yeah.
Because you want to fail on the small stage and make all your mistakes before you get on the big stage and it counts, right?
Yeah.
You want to fail when nobody knows. You want to test your game when you're not selling it yet. You don't want to go the whole thing and put it out on the market and nobody buys it.
Yeah.
You want to fix it before that point, right?
Before it's dead on arrival.
Yeah.
The movie ends, and you always know, like, these kind of films are always trying to pull at your heartstrings a bit. So, and the line of the storyteller who you mentioned, who kind of puts this whole thing together, he really focuses on, and this is I think the quintessential thing. It's almost one of those things that it's spoken about so much that it's now, how would you say it? It's expected almost, I would say, is that the foolishness of youth. And the one thing that I'm challenged with always is that how do I balance my experience against the foolishness of youth that can create things because it doesn't assume it can't be created because its experience hasn't told it that yet.
Yeah. I think there's always hope that the next generation will do things better than we did, right? Learn from our mistakes. I think that's transcended from the generations before us. And then we make our share of mistakes. And then we're trying to sort of learn from that and hope that the next generation does it differently. They'll make mistakes too, right? But it is, I mean, it was interesting because starting this process, we definitely did, the revelation at the end of the movie or the documentary is authentic. It was not just a sort of a hopeful ending put on it because, when we started and we were first talking about this, I mean, I even said to my colleagues, like, we will be fortunate if one team out of five does something successful because entrepreneurship is hard. Innovation is hard. And we cannot put artificial expectations like, well, three out of five need to succeed. Yeah. Like, we can't control that, right? Especially if we're going to try and do something meaningful. But we're still focused on most of the documentary you see is still focused on the product. And then sort of as you pan back at towards the end, you see the scope of this problem and how overwhelming it is. And the students are kind of coming to this realization, like, we need bigger systemic change, right? We need more. And for us, I think we really did realize that we are helping. Our goal is always to help the communities that we are immersing ourselves in on a small scale. But the bigger hope is that the journey our students go through unlock something in them that maybe this product or service doesn't change the world, but we have changed them and turned them into someone who will change the world in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or change their goals in life about making an impact on the world in a positive way versus I'm going to be the richest person I can be.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's when I look at like my life, I think, how can I be an example of the thing I'm hoping to see of more in the world? So not how can I get more out of it, but at least be consistent in a way that inspires others. And I hear that's very much what I hear you're doing as well, which is really beautiful. Yeah.
It's great. It's really exciting to see the students come out of this. It starts as sort of an exciting class and for so many of them, it comes out as something more meaningful, which is all we really hope for from them is to sort of be inspired to do more beyond our time with them.
Yeah. Thank you. We've come over our hour. It was really great to be with you. And if you need any support with your Notre Dame High School course, then I can certainly chime in on a few things here and there that might be helpful, of course.
Oh, yeah. That's great. We'll definitely drag you in.
Yeah, going back to the roots of it all. And I'm sure JC will leave with JC. Your coach tells you, you can't learn egg beater on deck. You got to get in the pool.
Very true.
Wisdom from Kentucky.
Thank you, Brad. It was lovely.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
It's a wonderful chaos.
We like it that way.